You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Kevin McLenathan.
And I'm Sarah Welch Larson. And Kevin, I have a sneaking suspicion you might just be the villain of this week's episode.
Little old me? What could I... How do you figure that? I'm just as nice as can possibly be.
I mean, well, for one... You're a man.
Okay.
Which is going to be a
bit of a problem. True. Please continue.
Given the subject matter of one of our movies. And two, you also made me watch a Charlie Kaufman movie.
Oh, I already see where this episode is going. Yeah. Listeners, we are going to be giving you an episode about the manifold sins of man. Yes, men specifically. Our review of Alex Garland's new horror film, Men, is coming up in the first segment.
And in the second segment, we engage with horrors of another sort. Anomalisa, Charlie Kaufman's 2015 movie, deals with the psyche of a man who is having a very difficult time relating with anybody.
Yeah, it's not a great time to have a Y chromosome, but you know, we'll keep on trucking on episode 336 of Seeing and Believing.
Hello.
Hi.
Mrs. Marlowe, yes?
Harper, yes.
Do, come in. The words
I have to say. It's a beautiful house. But
would it just be you staying, or?
Excuse me?
Mrs. Marlowe?
No. Until you give your love,
there's nothing more that we can do. Apple from the garden?
Yeah, it was delicious.
No. Mustn't do that. Forbidden fruit.
Oh. God, sorry, I'm joking.
We're here on episode 336 of Seeing and Believing, and I'm clean-shaven, unfortunately. Or, you know, I just have stubble. I don't have a mustache to twirl, in other words, which is unfortunate given that, you know, this is all about men being either villainous or dysfunctional or both.
I mean, you could shave into, like, the evil Spock beard if you really felt like playing the part.
I could be your evil mirror universe version of myself. Mm-hmm. I did not come prepared, is what I'm trying to say. So,
oh no,
sorry to you and to the listeners. We've got quite an episode ahead. Anomalisa is, you know, the crowd pleaser that's going to be in the watch list segment.
Crowd pleaser is a strong word for it, I think.
Just go with me.
Okay.
No, it's definitely not. But you know, before we get to the frothy delights of a Charlie Kaufman movie, we're going to kind of start off with something a little bit more somber, a little bit more restrained. That's not quite the right word, but we'll get into that.
They all defy description, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to attempt to describe this first movie now. That would be Alex Garland's new horror film from A24 titled Men. And here's the film's official synopsis. In the aftermath of a personal tragedy, a woman named Harper, played by Jessie Buckley, retreats alone to the beautiful English countryside, hoping to have found a place to heal. But something or someone from the surrounding woods appears to be stalking her. What begins as simmering dread becomes a fully formed nightmare, and Harper is confronted with a phantasmagorical manifestation of human evil that's as old as the human race itself, brought to you by the group that's named in the film's one-word title. So, Sarah, this is the sort of movie that, I mean, just once you know kind of the basics of what goes on in it, it's obvious that this is the sort of movie that is destined to be divisive and also to invite many varying interpretations, or at least maybe invite the audience to come up with lots of crackpot interpretations. So that might be as good a place to jump in as any. When it comes to Men, what are your quote-unquote crackpot interpretations, and what do you think of it as a whole?
I mean, I have a lot of crackpot interpretations about, like, men, the gender, honestly. Namely, are they okay? And I think that that's probably, like, I don't know, a surface-level read of Alex Garland's Men as well. I feel like we're kind of at a bit of an advantage here because the discourse has already sort of started to happen around this movie. And you're right that it's divisive, and I am probably about as surprised as anybody to say that I'm probably on the more positive end of that, which is not where I expected to be even as the credits rolled. So I did not have a particularly fun time watching this movie. This is not like fun horror where you're getting like an adrenaline rush and a bit of a thrill and like you're enjoying just sort of that pure fear and then catharsis and release. Like there's no catharsis here whatsoever. And I think that that's kind of the point, is that level of dissatisfaction that Alex Garland leaves you with. So my read, or my probably crackpot read on this particular movie, is that Alex Garland is interested in the question of original sin, but rather than positing that patriarchy is something that comes from that original sin, I think he's saying that patriarchy is the original sin, and that our main character Harper, played beautifully by Jesse Buckley, has to contend with that as sort of an Eve figure in what was once a lush and green garden that is turning into a more horrifying location. So that's kind of my read on it. I'm curious to know where you landed.
So I think that it's interestingly, we are probably almost exact mirror opposites of each other in terms of our reactions to this movie. I went in really excited about it. And despite the negative, the mixed to negative reviews that I'd been reading before going, I was still optimistic. Like I liked The Lighthouse, you know, Robert Eggers' film, and that was another one where it's just kind of crazy, and some people really didn't like it, and some people got on board with it. Mm-hmm. I was on board with it, and I was really hoping to be on board with this film as well. And I found myself, I don't know, disappointed is probably a good place to start with that.
I'm curious to know like what the thing was that most disappointed you.
Let's jump into that, because I think that might be a way to dig a little bit more deeply into the specifics of what you find this movie to be saying about the patriarchy and the religious or at least spiritual undertones of it. I think what was disappointing to me about it is I was really hoping for the phantasmagorical, that word that was in the plot synopsis. I was really hoping for it to go all in. I was kind of expecting it to be, I don't know, maybe along the lines of a David Lynch film, or maybe at least, Alex Garland's own Annihilation, where there's a lot of suggestiveness in the horror, where there's a lot that isn't explained, but there's still kind of this totemic sort of vibes behind it that would just allow you to feel with the movie, even if you didn't necessarily couldn't enumerate what the movie's point is. And I was disappointed in Men because it seemed like it kind of wanted to have it both ways. It wanted to be very, you know, Lynchian, just sort of have things follow this sort of dream logic or nightmare logic. But it also, it was disappointingly literalistic in places that made it, as the film went on, progressively less and less interesting for me to unpack what it was doing. Because I feel like even if I don't, have a checklist of what represents what in this film, I feel like I could do that if I wanted to, buckle down and apply myself. I just don't think that the movie has the sort of power to it that makes me interested in doing that.
Interesting. Because I feel like I've almost tried to do the checklist of one-to-one and I haven't been able to quite get there, except for with the main thread of that patriarchy equals original sin piece there. So we'll avoid a lot of the plot specifics, and especially the specifics of a truly bonkers third act. Which is something that I don't know, that felt kind of phantasmagorical to me, potentially. I know I said we weren't going to get into it, but also.
Well, so it it's very outré, I guess. Like, yeah. There's, you know, if you've seen The Thing, mm-hmm. then you're primed for the sorts of imagery and horrific events that occur kind of in this film's final sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. I felt that it was kind of one note in that kind, in that sort of grotesquery. It was definitely gross.
Okay.
I don't think it was gross in an interesting way, though.
Interesting.
I think there's a close up of a certain. Again, dancing around for both spoiler reasons and because this is a family show reasons.
Yeah.
There's a close up of a certain event or occurrence in this film's climax that is very gross and is very thematically in line with what Garland is trying to say here.
Mm-hmm.
And he returns, that same occurrence pops up again, mm-hmm. and then pops up again, and every time we're treated to that close-up, and it's every bit as gross the second and third times, but it doesn't elaborate on the thematic thrust of the image in a way that, in any sort of way that I found compelling. So it weirdly, even though it is kind of bonkers and self-consciously so, it kind of got monotonous for me.
Did you get that feeling throughout the rest of the film? Because I feel like there are bits and pieces where if I tried to map out one-to-one, like this is what's going on in, I don't know, Genesis 2 and 3 in particular, like there's a very strong Garden of Eden, Fall of Humankind kind of bent to this movie. And there are bits and pieces where it's very clearly signaling, oh yes, this is what's going on. Harper takes an apple from the garden, eats it, and then somebody else tells her, oh no, you shouldn't do that, like that's forbidden fruit, and then he elaborates that it's a joke. But there are other elements to this story where I was a little bit baffled about their inclusion, and I think that I don't know if it's necessarily adding additional depth or complexity, but I think that it is trying to be a little bit more slippery about that one-to-one kind of mapping from this movie to a biblical story. I'm thinking in particular of some of the carvings that show up in the church that Harper visits in the village nearby. On the baptismal font on one side, there is the figure of the Green Man, which is kind of a folk carving that shows up in English churches in particular. And we don't really know like what the purpose of this carving is. He just seems to be like a proto man out there. And then on the other side, there's also a Shilinigig, which is another figure that shows up in a lot of church carvings, and we don't really necessarily know what she represents either, other than femininity. And I think that the movie returns to these again and again in kind of an interesting way, and I couldn't fully put like my finger on, like, this isn't really an Adam and Eve story necessarily. It's more of a story of this is the problem of original sin, and then this is how we're going to explore that problem, but we're not going to necessarily map individual characters to those figures, if that makes sense. So I don't know if you got that sense or not.
I mean, there's definitely a lot of... I mean, this might be a mean way to put it. There's definitely a lot of faffing about with,
okay.
with that kind of imagery where it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's very, you know, it's not explained, and it's sort of a head scratcher, and the editing is definitely designed to keep the audience on its toes and sort of invite us to think about the links between these images that are cross-cut with the more literal tribulations that Harper is going through over the course of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there wasn't anything in there that compelled me to look closer, I guess. It's a lot like Mother in that it very intentionally draws on, you know, biblical and especially Old Testament accounts of humanity and our relationship to creation and maybe even a creator. There's definitely very intentional work done by Aronofsky in that film to make us, invite us into really unpacking it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And even when there's lots of crazy stuff going on, It's not just there for shock value. It's there to have a meaning. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that's true of Garland's film as well. But where Mother, I felt like, had a very specific, like it had interesting things to say, I guess, about God and man. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that Men has similarly interesting things to say about the patriarchy, other than that the patriarchy really sucks, which is true. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting as far as it goes that it posits kind of this link between patriarchy and original sin. Mm-hmm. But I don't, it has that idea, but I don't feel like it embroiders it in any particularly compelling way, for me at least. But I'm interested, I want to hear you talk about it more, because you had a really good essay in your newsletter, mm-hmm. which I read and I appreciated.
Thank you.
I wasn't convinced by it.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe you'll convince me now, or you'll convince some of our listeners.
I mean, I certainly hope so. It's interesting that you bring up Mother, because I feel like Mother was a movie that I actually like actively enjoyed watching, which is probably a very weird thing to say. But like, I actually actively enjoyed watching that one because I figured out what Aronofsky was up to with his story and with the parallels that he was drawing with the story of the Old Testament, and then later on the New Testament a little bit as well. With Men, I think I was baffled, and I think what you've described as kind of like faffing about, I feel like is almost more of an invitation to contemplate the state of the world and the nature of things. So there's a lot of like long, slow shots of the carvings in the church and of the leaves on the trees and of a dead deer sort of decomposing, where like the camera slowly moves into its eye and then back out again. And it's moved along a little bit, I guess, in the world. And at the same time, it's kind of unchanged. It's just kind of sitting there dead, and nothing really like of substance has changed. And I think that that's the thing where I think that Men is both successful, and also it falls a little bit short for me. And it's that Men has this thesis about men bad, patriarchy bad, maybe not necessarily like men bad, but definitely patriarchy bad. And also here's how this whole situation might have come about. Now let's sit and contemplate that. Part of me wishes that he had like a little bit more of a point to make with that beyond just here's my thesis and now let's think about this for a little while. And at the same time, I think I would have been really frustrated if his film had been an attempt to solve the problem of patriarchy, as though like anybody else would have been able to do that in the last like however many thousands of years that it's exist. I don't know. I'm frustrated by this movie, and I think I'm captivated by it. And I think I lean more on the positive side of that's an interesting problem, and I appreciate that I'm being invited to contemplate it through Alex Garland's eyes. And while I wish that there was a little bit more of a point to it, I also appreciate that it's not didactic about where do we go from here, because I think that I would have chafed at completely and totally if some guy had decided to make a movie that said, here's how you get out of this problem.
Well, yeah, we can definitely agree on that point. I think where I'm kind of just chafing under this movie myself is that I don't think any of the images that Garland chooses to explore this theme, this topic, are sticky in a way. They seem like there's individually striking sequences. You know, there's that the sequence where Harper, she wanders through a ravine and finds an old abandoned train tunnel, and she walks, you know, part of the way in there, and she's sort of playing with her own echo, you know, like kind of almost singing with herself, and then at the end of her self duet, there's a figure that stands up at the other end of the tunnel and begins running towards her.
And screams.
She's essentially awakened something. Mm-hmm. And that is, it's such a fantastic sequence. And this was early enough in the film that I was still very much on board. And I was like thinking, oh, this is really confidently filmed. This is confidently filmed. It's an interesting hook. Where does the movie go from here? And to my disappointment, the film doesn't really go much of anywhere. I was hoping for something like, I don't know, you think of something like David Lynch's Eraserhead, where every single sequence is very strange and indelible, but in a completely new way. You know, you don't necessarily, you can't rationally draw a link from one scene necessarily to the next, other than that there's just generalized anxiety that Lynch, he doesn't just, you know, show the characters being anxious, he makes the audience feel anxious. And I think Men, the second part of that equation is where Men falls down. Garland is very good at putting Harper through the ringer and can maybe creating some individually tense sequences, but there's not really that atmosphere that I wanted. There's not really any sort of image that is just so strange that it sticks in my mind. Nothing like the people who have turned into flowering trees of annihilation, or the Winkies diner sequence from Mulholland's Drive. Just something where there's no particularly rational reason why it's so sticky, but you can't stop thinking about it once you've seen it, and it moments like that kind of cast their shadow over the entire film, and Men just doesn't cast a shadow for me.
It's interesting because I think the shadow that's cast the most is that tunnel sequence that you mentioned. Like, for me specifically, like, that was the moment where I started to actually feel a lot of that anxiety, even before she started to enter the tunnel and start singing with herself and harmonizing with herself. And I can't necessarily tell you exactly why, other than, like, it felt like just a single camera push. It's probably the shot where she just first starts to enter the tunnel and the camera pushes in and you can't see the walls of the tunnel anymore. It's just the figure of Harper standing there and there's nothing else but blackness around her. And she's not aware of that darkness yet. But we know that it's there and we know what's coming just by nature of the genre of the movie that we're all watching. And I think that sense of anxiety kind of spread itself throughout the rest of the movie for me. There are a couple of sequences, and yeah, they do feel a little bit disjointed. Like, I will grant that. But there are a few sequences where Harper doesn't know that she is necessarily in danger, and we don't know that she's actually in danger, but there's still that sense of there's someone coming out of the woods for you. And maybe he doesn't know that he's coming out of the woods for you either, but he's here and he's at your house and he's exploring your grounds. And that level of kind of a nameless, like, I don't know, proto horror really got me. There's a couple of sequences where she's just walking around on the phone with a friend and you can see someone in the background, like through the windows in the cottage that she's in. And it's the kind of thing that makes me want to just, like, go around closing all of the curtains whenever I'm home alone. So sequences like that were the ones where I truly did feel seen and understood in this particular movie in a way that didn't feel fully literal, but close enough that it cut pretty close to home.
I mean, that's partly what is so frustrating to me about this movie is I think Garland's a very talented director. The way that he frames these shots, the way that he conceives of these sequences, where even if there's nothing out those windows, there's so many shots where Harper is sitting down with her back to a bank of windows, and you're not sure what's in the darkness outside. Is something watching her through those windows? You don't know, and that's really wonderful horror filmmaking. But I think that it either needs to be, you know, to fully embrace kind of that thrill ride mentality of we are just here to, you know, be scared for Harper, or it really need to be a lot more interested in creating a spiritual dread to go along with the physical fear, I guess. Like, I'm just, there's something there where Garland is sort of, he's caught between two stools where he's very good at evoking certain anxieties in individual sequences, but there's nothing that coheres them all together in a single unified product, at least for me.
Rory Kinnear didn't do it for you?
Sorry, what?
Rory Kinnear didn't do it for you?
I mean, So Rory Kinnear, he gives his all in this movie. And I mean, he gives his all. And it doesn't give me pleasure to say that, you know, for somebody as, you know, game and as Kinnear is in this film, I feel like the conceit of having him essentially play every single male role in this film, it by the end, it feels a little gimmicky to me.
Hmm.
And that makes me sad because Kinnear, I think, gives an incredible, you know, his performances in this film are really great. He plays kind of this plummy, you know, country landlord.
Mm-hmm.
He's got sort of this very cold policeman. He's got the stalker who follows Harper out of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of these things. He's the Anglican priest,
yes,
who is, you know, disturbing in a whole different way. Every single one of them, he changes his voice, his posture. Everything about the performance is different and it's really impressive. But in the end, I don't know that it does. I don't know that the film really explores what's interesting about that. Because there's something interesting about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the film really succeeds in explicating it for us.
I wonder if it's because Harper never seems to register that all of the men around here look the same.
It's unclear whether this is dream logic or, you know, where she notices it but it doesn't phase her, or is this something that she doesn't notice,
mm-hmm.
or is this something that she does notice and it's scaring her but she's not letting it show? It's ambiguous but in an unhelpful way.
I mean, I think that it is literally happening, and two, it's also a metaphor for, like, all of these guys are every man. It's just that they all inhabit completely different roles, and they inhabit roles where every single one of these men is going to behave the same way that all of these other men do, but they also are not going to, because they're still individuals. They just happen to be men living under patriarchy who don't believe this particular woman. And because she is not of them, she is also therefore kind of a threat that needs to be taken out. And that's kind of where a lot of the dread comes from me is where the dread comes from for me is that she is stuck in this situation where every man is both literally completely different and also literally exactly the same. And they're going to essentially sort of all turn into each other. And they're going to, like, all of these characters just sort of, the word I keep wanting to use is, like, they kind of melt into each other at a certain point. Like, Rory Kinnear's performance almost seems like it's coming towards a point towards her in particular. And I think the read that I most got from this was that patriarchy is something that is going to perpetuate itself and that is going to protect itself, because that's what power does, is it perpetuates itself and it protects itself. And I think that in and of itself is much more scary than any bodily harm that you can do to a person, because you can trap them in a situation that they are never going to be able to get out of. And even if they are able to recognize the situation that they are in, they're still stuck there unless they can figure out some way to get out. And in Harper's case, like, she's not able to necessarily get out. And I don't know if Alex Garland certainly doesn't seem to have, like, an idea about whether or not we can get out of patriarchy, but I think that leads us right back to the beginning.
Well, I think this is where your read on patriarchy equating to original sin is really compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes me wish that, honestly, I could get on board with everything else about the film, because I think that's kind of the key to reading this film, is that it's not so much that, you know, Harper's the, you know, our heroine and all of these other men are just, you know, monsters to be slain.
Mm-hmm.
There's something in the film's final sequence, there's something deeply pathetic about these men too. They're caught in a cycle of birth and death,
mm-hmm.
and it's deeply miserable for them,
mm-hmm.
as it is grotesque and horrifying to her.
Mm-hmm.
And when she finally gets the chance to sit down and essentially ask one of these manifestations what he wants from her, the answer is simply,
For you to love me.
Yeah, he wants love. And that's an expression of a very human spiritual hunger, mm-hmm. right? Intimacy, connection, love, if not with a creator, then at least with our fellow humans.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the way it's expressed in patriarchy is obviously very toxic.
Yes.
So I really like that read. I really wish that Garland had found a more compelling way to embody it on screen. Mm. I guess I can't take that final step where I agree that it's an effective portrayal of these ideas, mm-hmm. just that I give Garland some credit for at least having those ideas kicking around somewhere in here.
This feels like the battle of the sexes continues once again with our conversation as well.
You know, it seems thematically appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, you can judge for yourselves if we were successful at embodying that dynamic. We're also really interested in knowing your thoughts about men itself. If you've had a chance to see this film, there's obviously a lot to dig into about it, mm-hmm. and a lot of idiosyncrasies to have idiosyncratic reactions about. So let us know your thoughts if you had a chance to see it. You can email us at seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com or tweet us at cbelievepod. This is definitely a film that feels like it was made for film Twitter discourse in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
Which, might be another reason why I'm a little bit down on it. But in any case, it does make good for great Twitter conversation. So hit us up on Twitter and let us know your thoughts on there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So listeners, this is the part of the show after we spent a first segment just arguing with each other,
mm-hmm.
Where we typically, you know, read out some of the feedback that we get where you argue with us or maybe agree with us. We tend to like both, but for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things we really like is keeping that conversation going. So we don't have anything to share this week, but we definitely want to extend that invitation as always. And I'm, to be honest, Sarah, I'm really hoping that lots of people did see Men and want to tell us exactly where we're wrong or maybe where I'm wrong for not fully appreciating the brilliance of the original Sin reading.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know, hopefully it'll happen.
Yeah, everybody write in if you think that Kevin is wrong and if you think that I'm wrong, maybe write in about something else potentially.
No, that well, see, this is the sort of friction that comes about because of the fall and just fallen human nature. Yeah.
I will not stand for it.
This is the kind of post-lapsarian friction up with which I will not put. but as you can see, listeners, we're still sort of at loggerheads about Men. And I don't think that atmosphere is going to go away anytime soon.
Mm-mm.
Coming up is our watch list segment. We're going to talk, hopefully.
Probably argue.
Argue about Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson's Anomalisa. That's coming right up.
We're going to go to the watch list, which is the segment where one host recommends a movie that the other host hasn't seen. Usually, they're pretty thematically tied with whatever new release it is that we're discussing. So in this case, Kevin picked a movie in which just about everybody is also played by the same man. Kind of rhymes with Men and Rory Kinnear. But in this case, all men are played by Tom Noonan.
Not just all men, all people.
That's true. Yes, you're right. Thank you for correcting me. All people, except for two, crucially, are played by Tom Noonan. So, listeners, we are going to be talking about Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson's movie Anomalisa from 2015. Michael Stone, who is played by David Thewlis, not Tom Noonan, is a customer service expert who is due to speak at a conference, but who can't seem to be necessarily inspired to talk about the thing that he is most has the most expertise in, I guess we should say. He's really not inspired by really anybody or anyone, to be clear. He seems to be very bored with his lot in life and with everybody else. They all look and sound the same, largely because they have the same facial features and are also voiced by Tom Noonan. We're going to keep coming back to that piece because I do appreciate that piece quite a lot. That being said, his boredom is shattered when he hears the unique voice of Lisa, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, who he meets at a conference and who he thinks just might rearrange his life for the better. So, Kevin, I'm curious to know, I mean, I know that you picked this movie because it has a lot to do with the specific viewpoint of a very specific man, I think, and also there's an actor who plays like multiple individual roles, but I'm also curious to know, because this is a very like visually striking movie. It's done in stop motion. Was there any piece of this that stood out to you from Michael's, I don't know, assumed boredom? Like, was there anything in there that kind of broke you out of that shell? Because frankly, I'm kind of having a hard time coming out of that piece.
I mean, this is a film that is, in a lot of ways, you know, as Charlie Kaufman as it's possible to get. Just the common Kaufman themes of sort of being trapped within your own neuroses, of being unable to truly have healthy connections with other people. That's all here and taken to the nth degree. And I think the production design and the animation are sort of perfectly suited for it, because it allows Kaufman to control the visuals of the film to such a degree that what we see on screen is very much a manifestation of the psychic state of Michael Stone himself. This is a film, like, there are lots of films that have done very well at situating the audience very squarely in the viewpoint of a main character. I think this one is exceptionally successful at it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with the fact, you know, there's kind of this, it's a very beige movie. All the characters obviously look the same. They all kind of have this very bland mannequin like very white features, and that makes the moments where there are kind of flashes of beauty all that much more striking. And I think watching it this time, I found that in the eyes of these stop motion puppets. So they're kind of felt. They all have very bland features, and yet I'm not quite sure how they did it, but Duke Johnson and Kaufman succeed at really making Michael's eyes expressive. These aren't just the eyes of a puppet. They seem like the eyes of a person. And what would be more appropriate for a story like this than to give the audience the impression of a real person who's trapped inside a puppet's body and is just really trying to make some sort of connection and is completely prevented from doing that because he's just a very pathetic, selfish person. If that sounds like a bummer, listeners, that's because this movie is a bummer. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's a big bummer, but I think there's some value in really letting yourself enter that perspective and understand what a horror it is and be so much more thankful for the fact that we are not trapped in the same hell that Michael Stone is.
Yeah, and that I think is the place where like I'm struggling the most with this movie, because I do think that it is... I think it is good, and also I did not like it.
Fair.
And I am struggling to come to grips, I think, with the pieces that I did not like, because part of them feel to me like they're kind of a piece of a whole, and a lot of it has to do with the thread of self-loathing that I feel kind of permeates a lot of Charlie Kaufman's work in particular. And I have a sneaking suspicion I'm just not on this guy's wavelength, probably. But in this one, it felt so strongly distilled that like I could feel my spine sort of tense up as I was watching it. And I was frankly kind of grateful that it was over, even though it was only a 90-minute movie. It's an incredible work of art. And I don't know. I don't know. I just have a really hard time spending so much time behind the eyes of this one particularly very miserable character and kind of being inured into his view of the world, because I could sort of start to feel myself seeing the world the same way that he did at a certain point. And I didn't like how that made me feel, for one. And I don't know what exactly I got out of that experience necessarily.
So let me say that, first of all, I totally sympathize with that viewpoint. I have that a lot with David Lynch, actually, where I very much appreciate what Lynch does in his films. But I often come away from them feeling like I've just been punished for something that I didn't do. and a lot of it is, Lynch and Kaufman are both so good at situating you in kind of this experience that it is very artistically commendable and impressive. And it is also sometimes very, very unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So I totally sympathize, because I have the same thing. So when people talk about David Lynch, I'm like, he's great. I don't like a lot of his films.
Yeah.
I don't like watching them. I don't like the experience of sitting down with them. So that said, my defense for this particular film that, you know, in front of us, is the saving grace of this film is Lisa herself. Jennifer Jason Leigh's voice work is so good in this film. Lisa herself, she is also carries her own weight of self-loathing. She is introduced to us kind of over and over. When we first meet her, she talks about how she thinks she's ugly, she's unremarkable, she says that she's not very smart. So she's obviously carries a lot of that weight herself. But whereas Michael is just a miserable man who makes the people around him miserable, Lisa is sort of a ray of hope in this film, because by the end of the film, she does kind of grow as a person. She grows out of some of the self-loathing and misery that she had at the beginning of the film. And the connection that she forms with Michael, however unhealthy and sinful it might be, that's partly responsible for sort of bringing her out of that funk a little bit and showing her that there's a whole world out there beyond just her own neuroses. And because the movie ends on her rather than on him, that's kind of where I feel like the film is more than just an exercise in pure miserabilism.
Yeah. And I totally agree with you about that ending, because it is very, very good.
It's very needed.
It was, oh my gosh, I was going to be very upset if it did, I think, end with Michael and purely in his point of view. I take a little bit of issue with the character of Lisa, kind of the same way that I take issue with a lot of the other women in this movie. And maybe this is just how extreme the unreliable narratorness of Michael is. But every single woman in this movie is introduced as feeling extremely insecure about how she looks and how she presents herself to the world. Like, that's the first thing you hear from the ex that he calls up when he first arrives at the conference. It's the first thing that you hear from Lisa as well. Like, she talks about, oh, I just took my makeup off, don't look at me, I'm ugly. And that's kind of a litany that's sort of repeated amongst all of these other women. And maybe that is just how Michael thinks that he sees these particular women. But there's also that thread of sort of self-loathing, I think, there too, that also feels a little bit external to Michael. And that rubbed me the wrong way. Purely because it felt like it was treating all of the female characters as being a little bit more shallow than this very admittedly, like, miserable man who is miserable, like, to the depths of his very soul. Like, his misery is very deep and kind of profound in a way. But also, it feels like he's kind of infecting all of these other characters around him in a way that I don't know that it's necessarily quite true to the world. I know that art isn't supposed to always be true to the world, but it's something that definitely did rub me the wrong way.
I mean, I think that you're onto something there when you say that the insecurity of the women characters in this film is probably a function of the fact that just everything is shot through with the same beige tones because it's, this is Michael's world.
Mm-hmm.
So that said, watching it the second time, this is the second time I've seen it, because to be fair, it is kind of a bummer and I haven't been always in a hurry to revisit it. So this is only my second viewing after having seen it the first time back in 2015. But the watching it the second time, I was struck by the intensity of Lisa's lack of self-worth.
Mm.
The way that she talks about herself is not so much insecure as self-hating, I guess. And I can definitely appreciate that being just a little too much, almost as if Coffin's just laying it on a little bit too thick, where she didn't necessarily need to be that much of an insecure person for this story to be told in the way it is.
Mm.
So I think there might be something there in that critique, but I think, again, just if we're really going to exact a full look at the worst, if we are going to tell a story where we see somebody who has the opportunity to be thankful for all the good that he has. I mean, Michael is he's a successful speaker. He's a successful author. He's rich enough to be traveling around and staying at fancy hotels.
Mm-hmm.
He has a wife and a son who care about him. All the women he meets see him as physically attractive. That's mm-hmm. something that is brought up multiple times. And even as he's walking around, you in the sound mix, you hear other people say, "That's Michael Stone. That's Michael Stone."
Mm-hmm.
And he's famous enough that he's being recognized wherever he goes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all of those things he takes as a curse. Like there's something, he's so attached to his own misery that even the good things make it even more bitter for him.
Hmm.
And the fact that people recognize him is oppressive rather than kind of, something that he can be happy that has that level of success.
It's funny because I kind of read that almost as narcissism, like more of that unreliable narrator piece. Like he thinks everybody is looking at him, but maybe that isn't actually the case. So that was the read that I got from that. Maybe I'm being too hard on Michael Stone, but I don't know. This guy's really inviting that.
I mean, I'm actually want to talk about Michael Stone a little bit because we've hit it really hard that he is a miserable, selfish person.
Mm-hmm.
He's making the people around him miserable. He's no fun to be around. He's even less fun to spend time inside his brain space.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know, while watching this film, did you hate him? Like, did you dislike him? And that, because he is a very dislikable character,
mm-hmm.
Or did Kaufman succeed in, like, did he fail by making Michael just so repellent that you just want him to go away? Or did he succeed in at least making him compelling or inviting of some sort of sympathy?
I pitied him. And I think I saw some of the worst tendencies of myself in him. So I think that he succeeded, honestly. So I didn't actively hate him, but I was relieved to be out of his head, if that makes sense. So I do think that Kaufman is extremely successful in what he sets out to do in this movie. It's just that I did not enjoy it at all.
Successful at making an experience that you're not anxious to have again.
Yeah, no, I mean, it made me anxious. I'm just not anxious to have it again necessarily. I kind of want to talk a little bit about like the pieces that I appreciated like the most, though, which is kind of the artistry and actually the cinematography, because it's very, very good here. And I think that it does a good job of kind of driving home both what it's like to live in this guy's head, and also kind of recognizes that there is a world outside of his head, I think. Sorry. I had it written down and I wrote too small. So Joe Passarelli is the cinematographer, and he's actually doing a lot of stuff with some really interesting, really long shots, which I know are possible to do in stop motion probably more than like actual physical shooting. But I was still struck by the level of like time and attention and care that was taken into making sure that everything was completely and perfectly steady and kind of boring, and at the same time kind of fascinating to look at. Like, I kept searching the corners of all of the different frames, and I kept coming back to, in Michael's hotel room, a lot of the shots are framed so that we're facing back towards the door of the hotel room. And he's usually like sitting on the bed or standing kind of parallel in profile, and you can really tell what he's thinking, and he's talking aloud to himself. And the door to the hallway is kind of just a little bit left of center, and it's black. Like, it's a black hole. And I think I can see that almost as being his fear of the outside, fear of other people, fear of connection, maybe. But it was a detail that I kept noticing and coming back to. And I don't really have like anything else too profound to say about it other than like that dark door, I think, was one of the scarier things that I saw in this movie.
I love the production design in this film. And a lot of it is just the way the Hotel Frijoli is laid out and shot. The thing that popped out to me, I hadn't noticed that thing about the door being just kind of this black hole. Mm-hmm. The thing that I find so striking about this this hotel are the corridors. Just how the doors to all these different hotel rooms seem to stretch on forever, and there are ceiling lights placed at regular intervals, and just Michael walking down those hallways looks like a man walking towards his own, like walking down an endless road at the end of which is just oblivion. If you can ever get there, it's just like this infinite slog. And it's, again, if that sounds like a bummer, yes.
You're really selling this movie.
I mean, I'm sure that there are just tons of listeners out there just, immediately going to their Amazon Prime accounts and like, I gotta watch this. Rent. Pause the podcast. I'll finish the episode after I watch this really fun movie. But all of these little details, I think, do add up to create an experience that's more than just sort of watching a sad person be sad for an hour and a half, and then at the end of the movie he's going to continue being sad.
Yeah.
and that's all there is. I think it takes talent to make something boring and or ugly interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. And I think the cinematography, the direction, the production design all really succeed in doing that.
Did you get a sense of, I don't know, interiority from any of the other characters besides Michael Stone? Because I keep looking for that piece, and I couldn't quite fully get there.
100%. I think the character of his ex is very interesting to me, because she's the first non-Michael character we see on screen. So the film opens. He's on an airplane. He's reading a letter that she wrote him when they first broke up a decade ago. Mm-hmm. So that's a telling character detail himself, that he still has that and still reads it. But then we see her kind of superimposed over the image of the letter, reading out her words, where she's obviously just in such pain over the selfish way in which he ended their relationship. Mm. And Noonan's voice work is so interesting, because he's able to, even though he's voicing a cast of thousands, he manages to find specificity in each of the characters. And this ex, when we eventually see her in the flesh, Michael invites her over to the hotel, hoping to maybe get a little bit of adultery in, because he's just that terrible. But the exchange they have, where she's obviously still carrying a lot of emotional pain for him, and yet she's not just going to let him use her to make his life a little bit less dull for a while. She's still, there's still an ember of self-respect that she has. And I found that to make her a compelling character for the little amount of time that we actually get with her.
I think this is making me respect her a little bit more as well. Because again, like most of what I got from the movie was kind of his colored view of her, where there's just that level of self-loathing. And I think the first thing that she says to him after he calls her up is like, don't look at me. I think I've put on weight, like, but not bad, but also don't judge me for any of this. And it just keeps coming. I keep coming back to that piece because that just does not feel, I don't know. It feels uncharitable in a way that makes sense coming from Michael Stone's head, but it doesn't quite jive. At least I hope it doesn't jive with like the rest of the world outside of it. And I have a really hard time squaring that circle.
And there's probably a limit to how often you can pull the ripcord on the unreliable narrator parachute.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fair. I want to talk a little bit about the way that these stop motion puppets are constructed.
Yes.
First of all, the hotel at which they're all staying is the Hotel Frigioli, which is a reference to Frigioli's disease, which is this persistent delusion that the friends and loved ones that you have around you are not actually your friends and loved ones, but people who are disguised as your friends and loved ones. And these puppets are all constructed in a way where their faces are, the seams are very obvious. Kaufman makes no attempt to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, at various points, the face plates of these puppets either move around or pop off to reveal kind of the puppetry underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to know kind of what you made of that and what you see as Kaufman. What is Kaufman saying about people? Obviously, because some of this is all in Michael's head, but mm-hmm. Michael himself also has those seams in his face. And so I'm curious to know what you see as the vision of humanity, not from Michael, but from Kaufman with this movie.
I mean, I still read it just as how he sees the world and how he sees himself, where he kind of sees everybody else as being interchangeable and he's still a little bit unique. I almost wish that there had been a little bit more done with those faceplates. Like, I'm glad that there's some touches to it and there's that moment where part of like his mouth sort of falls off. And maybe this is kind of my frustration with the movie as a whole, as being so deeply like mired in his head that you don't get to do quite as much with the medium of stop motion. There's an incredible dream sequence
mm-hmm.
where everything that Michael hopes for and fears sort of starts to happen all at once, where he ends up going down to the basement of the hotel to be confronted by the manager. And the manager confesses his love for Michael, and then everybody else proceeds to do the same. And they kind of chase him and Lisa down this darkening hallway back towards that same dark hotel room where he's been sort of hiding behind this entire time. And there were some flourishes in there that felt like they were something that could really only ever happen in a stop motion feature. And I kind of... it made me wish that I wasn't watching something that was so beige and so regular. And at the same time, like, I don't know how you tell this story without this particular medium. So again, it's that internal friction against the self-loathing and against the reliable narrator and just me bumping up against it. The problem is probably with me, but I do have a very big problem with this movie.
I don't necessarily blame you. I mean, do you think that the film is funny at all? Because it does have some, at least I find some threads of humor that kind of also help the bitter medicine go down a little bit easier. Were you on the humor wavelength of this film at all?
I was completely like dead silent the entire time.
Oh.
Like, did not laugh, not find any of it funny. Like it was really a tough sit, honestly.
The final nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, I'm sorry to have afflicted you with that, but
all good.
That is the way the stop motion cookie crumbles. So listeners, that's our review of Anomalisa. If we haven't already sold it to you by now, You can always go out. It is available to stream on demand on Amazon Prime, I believe, maybe some other platforms as well. So you can check it out there. If you've seen this film and have some thoughts to share about whether you find it just an interminable sit or whether you actually, you know, agree with your humble host and actually think that it's a tough sit, but it's also kind of great. Mm-hmm. Let us know. You can always email or tweet us at those addresses that we mentioned earlier. Next week, things are looking up a little bit, though. Like, we'll have a little bit more fun on next week's watch list segment.
Depends on how bleak you find summer movie tent poles.
Well, yeah.
We will be watching Jurassic World Dominion. Mm-hmm. And then to pair with that, scientists spent so much time considering whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think about whether or not they should. We're going to be pairing Jurassic World with the 1931 Frankenstein. Kevin, I'm so excited to show this movie to you.
The original film about mankind's scientific hubris. I'm all about it, and I'm excited to see it. I feel like I'm getting a crash course in classic monster movies from you, and it's a big blind spot, so I'm looking forward to filling them in.
And also, I just love Boris Karloff, so I'm going to make everybody watch every Boris Karloff movie ever.
Well, hopefully, listeners, we can make you watch this movie as well so that you can, you know, follow along with the discussion. I'm looking forward to catching up with it myself. Mm-hmm. But for now, that is this week's episode. Hopefully, you're not currently in a tailspin of of just, you know, depression over Anomaly. So hopefully we help you pull out of it somewhat. Seeing and Believing is brought to you by the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm your host, Kevin McLenathan. My co-host is Sarah Welch Larson, and we'll see you next week on Seeing and Believing.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.